Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And what a journey we have for you today. It's a party. It's a Hanukkah party. We're having a talk about Delancey Street in New York City, the Lower East Side. And I have with me the authors and two contributors to the book called Eating Delancey, A Celebration of Jewish Food. Now, food memories are usually some of our very first memories. If not our first memories, often they are our most poignant memories, and they stay with us for a long time. So these two enterprising photo directors and photographers decided to do a book about it. And they are Aaron Resney, a photographer, and a food photographer and tabletop photographer.
Correct.
Aaron?
Correct.
Yes. Okay. And Jordan Shapps, who's a food director for a lot of publications and film?
No, a creative director.
I mean, not photo director. I'm sorry.
Yeah, photo director. And in other things, fashion and food and other areas as
well. Excellent, excellent. And joining us also, we have Kara DeSilva, who is a culinary historian and author and memoirist and expert at many things, and Arthur Schwartz, who is no stranger to radio. He is a radio personality and a cookbook author and a cooking instructor, and again, an expert in many things of cookery. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
To have here today. Aaron and Jordan, I want to start with you, and I want to know what inspired you to do this book?
Aaron.
Okay, so what was
thank
your inspiration?
You, Jordan. Thank you, Linda. Thank you for having us. It's very exciting for us. It means a lot. Just to make it simple, it started out as a very simple personal photography project. I've been doing photography virtually my whole life, and for many, many years I've been shooting commercial photography and doing pictures for hire for a lot of major magazines and a lot of, commercial companies. And about 4 years ago, I decided, it's time I get back to a little bit to my roots and do something for myself. Came up with the concept of Eating Delancey, and I got my team together, and we actually, three or four of us, schlepped down to Katz's and Economy Candy and Russ and Daughters, and we started shooting pastrami. We started shooting candy from Economy Candy. We shot an egg cream, and the people's reaction, the heartfelt feelings I had for the pictures, and wound up just turning into a project that people really reacted to and gave me a great deal of emotion. When I shot the glass of tea in a glass that I realized was in memory of my father, I realized, we were on to something that would mean a lot, not just to me, but to other people, people from my culture, people from New York. It wound up becoming a gallery show and got a fair amount of recognition. And I called my dear friend Jordan Shapps, my comrade, my coworker. Jordan and I started in the business many, many, many years ago at New York Magazine. And I think I'll let Jordan tell it where it came from there.
Okay. Aaron and I go back more years than I think I'd care to say right now.
It's radio. No one can see you. They don't know.
Right. And as I said, I have a face for radio.
Yeah.
But years and years ago, Aaron was a burgeoning photographer, and I was a burgeoning creative at New York Magazine, and we managed to hook up. And for years, Aaron was one of the key people I would go to give glory to New York Magazine covers and multi visual pages. And we stayed friends. I don't know how that happened, but we stayed friends after he went to more commercial things, and I got segued into books out of magazine. He called me up, and he said, I want to show you something. Come over. I want to show you something. It's all that need to be said. It was going to be worth it. He shows me these fantastic, heartbreakingly beautiful pictures. I mean, it's food as art, and yet that art is the Jewish history. I mean, it's breathtaking.
Well, evocative of so many memories. Oh, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Down to the placement of a spoon on the side of a bowl of soup, which I know Aaron would love to tell you about. But he said, I think there's a book there. What do you think? And I said, and he said, and we'll go 90%, 10%. Well, I sort of thought 90% is nice, but I can be a little more generous. And I said, first of all, I agree with you. There is a book there, and it's 50-50 on this. I said, but it's not just a book of photographs. Breathtaking though they are, it needs to be dimensionalized. It needs voices. We've got to go crazy and try for some celebrated people, famous people, important food people. And regular people, our Bubby, our Zadie, our next-door neighbors, you know. And I said it also needs shtick. It needs, I'm a comedian, it needs humor, it needs a little song, a little dance, a little seltzer down your pants. And it created a fusion. He and I then became Siamese twins.
Well, you certainly got it. It is all wrapped up in this book, marvelously so. And again, I'm going to back up a little bit because for our listeners, believe it or not, they're not all in New York. So for our listeners who aren't in New York City, Delancey, you have to describe, the book is called Eating Delancey, and of course, Celebration of Jewish Food. Tourists from all over come to New York City to experience some of the Jewish cuisine that still remains. So, Arthur... Yeah, okay. Tell us.
It doesn't really remain. No,
but
not
tell
much.
Then for history wise, because these are a lot of old photographs.
Well, let's say Delancey Street was the main thoroughfare of the immigrant Lower East Side. Not just for Jews, by the way, also for Italians and Irish.
Poles and Germans.
But after the turn of the century, it was largely Eastern European Jews. And Delancey Street, it's very fancy. Delancey Street, you know. Lawrence Hart, I don't know, wrote that probably in the 20s when maybe Delancey was sort of fancy. But in my day, it was anything but. Second Avenue was still a little fancy when I was growing up in the 50s. But there's not much left of that anymore. And the book tells a lot about what was and why it isn't.
Right. You know, Aaron, let me just say something.
We kind of use Delancey as a metaphor,
right. Of course.
You know, because it really represents all the delis that we grew up in Brooklyn and Chicago and different places in New York. But, you know, at one point, that's where the immigrants came. And at one point, it was the heart of, you know, the Jewish flavor of New York and probably the only place left.
Right. And you say, Aaron, you in particular said that you consider this book an homage to the vanishing flavors of your youth.
Correct.
And yet, all of you, and Kara, you as well, because you and we'll get to you about talking about your memories, fond memories of the bakeries, you all talk about how important the food of your family was and that much of these memories do take place at family meals. At celebration of family meals. So when you say vanishing in terms of, like Arthur said, it's no longer there, just like Little Italy is no longer, there's no Little Italy anymore. I mean,
it's vanishing.
So vanishing from people aren't cooking it. People.
Right, and a lot of it is related to health and not wanting those kinds of foods anymore.
I object.
Yeah, I'm not saying.
I object. Let's add a little, you know, really. If you look at the food...
I'm not saying that's right, Arthur.
Well,
I'm saying what people told me.
You people, they do. I just, the other day, I said this apparently on some internet thing, that, you know, just add broccoli. I mean, in Eastern Europe, they didn't have broccoli, okay? All they had was root vegetables and cabbage.
It's
a long winter. And when I was a kid, when we had things like tomatoes and cucumbers, they were called garden vegetables because in the old country, that was the only place you could get them, is if you grew them yourself in the summer. So, and there was limited, even that was limited because the growing season was so limited. So if you just add broccoli, a lot of this food isn't so bad for you after all.
That's right. Well, now, what I want to clarify is that all of you, all four of you grew up in Brooklyn?
No.
Okay.
She's
that was very quick.
Just the two A's.
Just the two A's. Arthur and Aaron grew up in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And Jordan?
Chicago.
Chicago.
Okay. And Miami Beach.
Comrade, okay.
And I grew up at the Jewish end of Manhattan, up in Washington Heights.
Well,
then
that's
the Jewish end
okay.
of Manhattan.
That's like Brooklyn. Okay. Yeah. So
but I think of it as sort of the northernmost part of Delancey
right.
Street.
And it's chopped liver that brings us all together.
There you go.
Just and other such. And also just a comment on what Arthur just said. I absolutely agree. Most people have talked about the fat in Jewish food, but now we have schmaltz as a possibly healthy ingredient.
That's right. That's right.
So they have to go backwards from what they were thinking.
That's right. You said that you, Jordan, you mentioned that the book would need some voices. It would need some shtick. And believe me, there's plenty of it in here. And you, I mean, to the point where you have food memories from the likes of Calvin Trillin, Don Rickles, Woody Allen, Jackie Mason, Robert Klein, and the introduction is written by the late and great Joan Rivers. A sad note to the book, but what a wonderful note to the book too, because she writes such, you know, such fun. She didn't grow up with the Jewish food on her table even, you know, but it came to her. The family brought it to her. How did you decide who to solicit? How did you solicit, and who did you have to cut?
Well, Aaron and I have been playing a game of creative toss and catch for 1,000 years. As a matter of fact, I always like to bring up the fact that we were once doing a piece for New York Magazine, and I think we had a $5,000 foie gras shrink-wrapped, and he and I were tossing it around like it was a football. But, you know, turning us off is more difficult than turning us on. We sat down and we just started going, Jackie Mason, Joan Rivers. We even wanted Sandy Koufax, the great pitcher, the great New York pitcher, who did not pitch an opening game of a World Series because it fell on Yom Kippur. And then we thought, we're crazy, but let's go for it. And we just, I'd like to tell this because it's so true. Certain people that we would get to, no matter how famous, no matter how intelligent, how decorated, if we would say to them, would you be interested? And they would say, oh, that's so interesting. Let me think about it. I'll get back to you. I'll go and write something. Didn't happen. But if we talked to someone like a Bette Midler and she said, oh, my God, I'll never forget. That they literally wrote it in an email or in a telephone call.
Right. I was going to say, all you have to do is talk to them, right? And yeah. Just write down what they say quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to be crazy about this, but there's a lot of people we wanted to have in the book that we couldn't because it was too much of a cornucopia. Yeah.
Is there such a thing as Hawaiian Jewish food?
No, Bette Midler said, she said to me, oh, honey, she said, I was born in Hawaii. I said, well, I know that, but your parents came to New Jersey. And she said, oh, by the time that we were in New Jersey, I was a vegan.
So, but then there were all the jokes about, you know, how the great thing about, you know, the only problem with Jewish food, what the Chinese guys say, is that two weeks later you're hungry, right?
You know, getting back to Joan, I think that was really a real turning point for us because obviously she's so well known, but she just wrote such heartfelt words, and she's not really known for someone that's a food person, but. A dear friend of ours, Abby Aronson, who helped us, you know, bring people into the book, she wrote for us. She had a strong contact with Joan. She'd met Joan before. And Abby just interviewed Joan, and we were just absolutely flabbergasted and about how she really just spoke so warmly and fondly of growing up in Brooklyn and eating Jewish food, and that she wanted to pass this along like I do and like we all did to our children and grandchildren. And it's kind of a little known fact too that when Abby was with her at another event, Joan was dressing, she was in the dressing room, and she saw a little tattoo on Joan's underarm, and it said 6M, and it was, and Abby said, Joan, what is that? And she said, that's in memory for, you know, all the Jews that we lost. And we're just really grateful and obviously sorry that she's gone, and we wish she was here to celebrate the book with us. But it was really a key moment for us for the book.
See, the thing about Joan Rivers that was so extraordinary, and I always loved the brittle, take-no-prisoners sense of comedy.
Absolutely.
And also, she was unbelievably chic and stylish, and she looked elegant even to the moment she died. She was an elegant breath. People don't realize she was also a bubby.
Mm.
She had a stake in her daughter and a stake in her grandson, mm-hmm. and that there was this very internal Jewish side to her.
Absolutely. So many of these people...
I love the line, too, that when she said that, you know, she was brought up eating kosher food, and her mother always said, the cows weren't slaughtered, they were nagged to death.
Well, it's the names that you have in the book, so much, so many of these people... famous directors, movie producers, comics for sure, and writers, they really brought a lot of the Jewish food and humor, but food to a large swath of the population of America and across the world. I mean, they celebrated it in their writings, in their jokes, in their humor. And Kara, you particularly... you know that food memories are so poignant, so important. You wrote the Memories...
Kitchen, in Memories Kitchen.
Memory in Kitchen, the women of Tabizan.
Oh.
Yeah. Tell us about how poignant those memories were, and just briefly, just like encapsulated.
The book Linda is talking about is a book of recipes written down by women who were starving to death in a concentration camp. And they were not for cooking. They were for remembering and for honoring and for reinforcing their identities, because food is about the most powerful identity marker that there is. And I was very struck last night. We were at an event at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, and we talked about this. When the pictures went up from the book, you could hear a gasp in the audience. Not just that the speakers were moving or anything of the kind, but you can visibly hear a stirring in the audience as they saw their brisket, their matzo balls, their chopped liver. It clearly was so evocative. It wasn't just, oh, what a beautiful picture. It just, you could feel it ricocheting through their soul. And that was so moving. And I think that's what's so moving and important about the book as a means of preservation of traditions that are disappearing necessarily or not. I think people are so hungry
to have a little taste of that history.
To have a taste and keep that history. And that's what these two have provided.
Well, what I want to do is talk a little bit more about the history that, as I say, a lot of tourists come to New York City trying to capture some of that. And when we come back after a very short break, we're going to talk about some of these historical places.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food. I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, we are back and talking about a wonderful new book, Eating Delancey, A Celebration of Jewish Food. And Aaron, you had mentioned that talking about the vanishing flavors of your youth, and what I wanted to do was talk about some of these vanishing places, these historical places that so many of us remember, and so many tourists come and try to capture a little moment of. And then there was one comment in the book by one of the former owners of one of those historical places, Ratner's, saying, real estate is a lot more valuable than the restaurant business. And is that the sad case that we're facing right now?
It's actually very unfortunate. And it's not just changing the Lower East Side and Jewish food. It's changing New York, you know, completely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's just when I started the project 4 years ago and went down and got all the stuff a couple of years later, you know, 3 years later when I did the rest of the photography, I was shocked at how much it changed in just those few years.
Yeah. And Ratner's being one of the places. Ratner's
was fantastic. There was two of them.
Yeah.
There was one on 2nd Avenue and another one on
Delancey.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, yet there's another side to this. Nothing in New York for sure is cut and dry. There are always cross currents. The Streit's matzo business.
Yeah.
The three guys who are now running it, cousins and descendants of the original owners.
On every supermarket shelf?
On every supermarket shelf. The story, not to change the subject, is they all moved out of the family business to do this, to become a lawyer and accountant, and wound up coming back. They are critically weighing their desire to stay in the neighborhood because they have four tenement buildings that are conjoined. The place looks like something out of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times with old equipment. It would be very easy for them to pick up and move to New Jersey, as Manischewitz did, and produce the same product for $10 billion less. But they feel committed to the history
of
the neighborhood.
Well, that's what Nikki Russ Vetterman said last
same
night
thing.
About Russ,
yeah.
And
Russ and Daughters.
That when they decided to open their restaurant, they looked all over and found various places and were close to signing, and then realized that emotionally the commitment to the Lower East Side, the 100 years of tradition of Russ and Daughters, that they had to stay on the Lower East Side. However, and they are. They're very committed to it, both the restaurant and the shop. But they're opening in the Jewish Museum. They're going to open a shop and a restaurant in the Jewish Museum.
So. But there are other people committed to their. This is in Brooklyn. I'm a big Brooklyn booster. Alan Rosen, the current owner of Junior's, has said that he will not sell his two-story building.
Which was great.
To have another high-rise there, even though he probably could have gotten a deal where Junior's would have reopened.
With the new Barclays Center there and everything. Yeah. I mean, he could have sold that for a fortune.
Right, and he's committed to keep. Well, look, it's a great franchise.
Yeah.
Let's not. And he's already in Manhattan.
That's right.
In Grand Central.
And at Penn Station.
And Penn Station.
Grand Central.
Yeah. He's in the food court at Grand Central.
Yeah.
And you could sit down. And by the way, some days, I don't go around testing it all together, but some days the pastrami at Junior's is every bit as good as it is at Cass's.
And the cheesecakes, I mean, and one of my good friends wrote the cookbooks with them. So they have cookbooks out too. You can buy the cookbooks, which is what I wanted.
Better baked at home. That's what I was going to say.
Well, yes. And Arthur, that brings me to my next point, and that is that there are not only are there wonderful photographs and quotes and memoirs from famous people and not so famous people about food, but there are recipes. Wonderful recipes. And Arthur, you have quite a few in here.
Well,
and
I wrote a Jewish cookbook myself called Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking.
He got his
and
plug in there.
I had to. And so some of the, I mean, I'm full of recipes.
Right. Well, and
I cooked with my grandmother and my grandfather. My father's father was a chef, actually.
Really?
And made, as they call it now, lacto-fermented pickles.
That was his, right.
That was actually that was actually his business. Was and during the Depression, he sold lacto-fermented vegetables off a pushcart to bars and grills, and he made coleslaw and potato salad. But no, he was a real chef, and he cooked more Italian food than anything. And my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who I lived with. I cooked with her from, I'm sure, an early age. They stuck a wooden spoon in my mouth and said, taste it, tell me. Yeah. Right. That's how I became a critic.
Well, there are also recipes from some of these iconic restaurants. And I have to say, Blintz's from Ratner's, the very first time I ever tasted a Blintz, I had had crepes and things, but it was 1968. A friend took me to Ratner's, and I had my very first Blintz. And I have to say that was a very special moment, and there's the recipe in the book. So let's talk. We talked about Ratner's. Okay, Ratner's, a dairy restaurant. First of all, people have to understand Ratner's is a dairy restaurant. Tell us a little bit about the background of Ratner's. Aaron. Get the Chicago boy in here to talk. Right?
Oh, I have a Chicago Ratner's story.
Okay, all right.
You know, I don't know exactly when Ratner's started, but I think it was in the early
1900s. It was the turn of the century, definitely.
But it had a significant presence, you know, when I was growing up. It had a significant rock and roll following. It was right next to the Fillmore. There's a wonderful picture by Elliot Landy of Janis Joplin eating at Ratner's the night it was open. The first night the Fillmore opened, the Grateful Dead ate there. The
Louis Sonkin ate there too. No, you're naming all these rock and roll guys.
Right.
My grandfather ate there, too.
But don't forget, Meyer Lansky ate there, too.
Uh-huh. Yes, they had the Meyer Lansky room. Yeah. It was a real significant...
My grandmother's neighbor, Meyer Lansky.
We have a wonderful story that Michael Lang told, another rock and roll person, about how him and Bill Graham had a sit-down at Ratner's. And frankly, to make a long story short, you know, the story ends that if it wasn't for pickled herring and Blintzes and Yiddishkeit food, the two of them wouldn't have agreed, and we never would have had the Woodstock Festival.
Absolutely. Woodstock Festival, bloomed at Ratner's.
And Michael said, the last quote is, he said, you know, I always wonder if it wasn't for pickled herring, what would have been?
Well, Jordan, you said you have a Chicago Ratner story.
Well, when I was growing up in the Jewish North Side of Chicago, I don't know, my crowd was all the younger brothers and sisters of older relatives. And when we were coming 16 years old to get a driver's license, someone's mother always had a car that we could steal. And the 16-year-olds would get in the car. I would be the driver because I would, you know, they'd all fall asleep and snore. I would wake them up when we had to pee and get gas. But we would drive to New York because someone had an older brother or sister going to Columbia, going to NYU, and we would be able to crash there and spend a weekend in New York, going to museums and second acting Broadway shows. The timing was such we would hit the city 3 o'clock in the morning and head to Ratner's.
Uh-huh. It was because it was open all night.
It was open 24 hours.
I think that was when I went at about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, okay. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, those little onion rolls on the table were still warm, potato soup and the baked gefilte fish. Yeah, being a dairy restaurant, my favorite memory of Ratner's is seeing a table of six nuns.
Wow. Yeah. Well, now, flip to the other side, non-dairy. We're talking Katz's. Katz is still alive and well, and people still lining up around, more so than ever. I live not far from it, and I will see lines around the block at all hours of the day. Buses.
Well, can I know a little bit of what because I'm friends with the family. I grew up with Jake Dell's mother. Jake is now the young manager of the restaurant. His father and uncle are the owners, and Jake is really out there. He's very charming. He's young. He's full of energy. And he gets a lot of publicity. So I think one reason that Katz's is as popular, more popular than ever. But, you know, Katz's was really a dump for a long, long time.
In a dumpy neighborhood.
The food was terrible. I mean, I would go anywhere for a great pastrami sandwich, but I wouldn't have gone to Katz's, I guess, in the 70s or 80s. I don't remember when exactly the Dell family bought it and increased the made the quality so much better. But it's hard to meet that old standard. But I have to say, I know somebody who grew up in New York who I took to Katz's for the first time when he was in his 50s. And he said, why would you come to such a shabby place? Mm. And I said, because it's full of history. It's, you know, but today's young people think that everything has to be shiny new.
Right.
Or, I mean, like Russin Daughters looks like it's old. They did a beautiful job evoking their retail.
It's 100 years old.
It's interesting. It's 100 years.
The cafe.
The way it looks.
Yeah. The cafe, right.
They evoked the old store. And
went to great pains to do
that. That's right.
And,
I mean, it's really
and
nice.
I just want to clarify, Russin Daughters, for people who don't know, Russin Daughters Appetizing is a fabulous store, over 100 years old, selling all sorts of smoked fishes and appetizing goods. And again, the line is out the door.
Nikki, Russ, and Josh
Tepper.
Tepper. Are the fourth generation owners, full of energy and also social media savvy and publicity savvy. And Nikki's father, Josh's uncle, Mark Fetterman, made the quality there the best you can buy in the world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Over the 25 years that he ran the business. Mm-hmm. And then he sold it to the next generation, handed over a gem. And they're doing, I don't know what the metaphor would be, but anyway,
they're doing
a great job.
Fantastically.
Bang up.
So these I call the keepers of the flame. There's still lot of them around.
And there are some people who grew up perhaps, you know, in the Bronx or in the north end of the city who, believe it or not, didn't know about Russ and Daughters. I couldn't believe they didn't know about Russ
and
Daughters.
No, I didn't know about Russ and Daughters. I knew about Jaime's Highway High-Grade Appetizing on King's Highway.
Right, and I knew about Dages, which was right. I didn't know about Russ and Daughters until I moved downtown.
Oh. And then, of course, we have Jonah Schimmel's Knishes.
Which are only good now. They didn't used to be.
Okay. No, that's true.
Okay, there goes history out the window.
I never would have eaten a knish at Jonah Schimmel's when I was a kid, or my father wouldn't let me. We would stop at Jonah Schimmel's for what we then called sour milk, but is really like kefir, is a yogurt type beverage, or borscht. They would have cold red borscht with sour cream stirred in already poured in the glasses on a little refrigerated shelf in the back.
Now, something that is sadly missing, and Kara, you wrote some nice memories about that, and those are bakeries. We don't have the great bakeries anymore.
Of the
Jewish bakeries, right. And tell us a little bit about what you remembered from what was so important to you.
I was remembering Inwood up in Washington Heights when I was a child, and how I was very bread-oriented as opposed to most kids. I was not...
You didn't want the donut, you wanted the bread.
I wanted the bread. And there were two bakeries, Cushman's and Hanscom's, and I could not open the door myself when I was 6 or 7. It was too heavy. And I remember so clearly begging my father, hurry up, get the door open, so I could get in and start picking from among their wonderful wares, or wonderful now in my memory, but especially Jewish corn rye, which has really disappeared from the city. It was this great, heavy, dense, fragrant rye bread that is one of my most potent memories, smeared with sweet butter and sprinkled with a little bit of salt. Recently, friends of mine and I were actually doing a search around the city for Jewish corn rye. We found a Best one, then it closed. And just at that moment, Nikki of Russ and Daughters re-imported from outside New York somebody who was a great baker. They made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And he came back to New York and he started making the Jewish breads of old. Brilliantly, brilliantly. I mean, I actually have tears in my eyes. Thinking,
and this is what they serve at Russ at the cafe, at Russ
and
Daughter's
And you can
cafe.
Actually buy the breads in the store, and maybe they'll start being distributed elsewhere. But that's the first Jewish corn rye I've had since they disappeared.
Hmm.
That was evocative of that memory from my childhood.
Well, we talked about famous people whose quotes and memories are in the book, and the different types of the different restaurants, some of the iconic restaurants around the city. Let's talk about the photographs, Aaron. And Jordan, who you directed, which ones, of course, would be placed how. But Aaron, you started out talking about the glass of tea. Tell us why the glass of tea.
Well, my father was an immigrant, a survivor, came from Poland and Eastern Europe. And in that generation, and people who, you know, transplanted themselves in this country, tea was drunk out of a glass. And, you know, he wouldn't know from drinking it out of a cup. And it was one of his greatest pleasures. And it was a fond memory. And after dinner, he'd sit and kibitz. And if people came from the old country family, they'd stay up all night drinking tea out of a glass. And not only was it out of a glass, but it was a specific type of glass, and it was his glass, and it had to be out of his glass. And if you notice in the picture, there's some sugar cubes next to it, and Jordan likes to tell that story.
I was just going to ask him to.
In Aaron's heartbreakingly beautiful photograph, and in fact, the book has more or less evolved into a tribute to Aaron's father for that charming and historical and cultural method of drinking the coffee, of the beverage. In the back of the picture, you'll see two beautiful little sugar cubes, and there's the glass of tea with the tea bag. And the thing is that not a lot of people realize this, you did not sweeten the tea. You took the sugar cube and you held it between your teeth and the front of your mouth, and as you poured the hot tea, the sugar dissolved and the tea became sweetened. And the funny thing is, if your grandparents, God willing, lived very, very, very old, you would see slight erosion around the top and bottom
of
the teeth.
Okay.
You know, there's one food item, and we talked about the bakery, that I think has made a resurgence from this book. And whenever people look at the book, we talk about it. We've done a number of slide presentations, and it's the Charlotte Russe.
Mm.
And I think that it meant more to me than it did to Jordan. And I'm sure Arthur, growing up in Brooklyn, remembers that, you know, it's not necessarily a Jewish dish, but it was such a key component of the Jewish bakery, especially in Brooklyn and especially in New York. And people remember, and they wrote about it, they talk about it, they call, and they say, you know, I can't believe it. I haven't seen a Charlotte Russe in years. She said, I remember schlepping with my mother, schlepping with my grandmother. We'd go to the butcher, we'd go to the fish store, we'd go to the, you know, they do all their shopping. They end at the bakery, and they would leave as their treat, and taking home this very simple recipe of a Charlotte Russe, and people look at it, and they just smile.
When I was a kid, and we'd go to Fordham Road with my mother, there was actually a Charlotte Russe stand. That's all they sold. It was a tiny little store, and that was the treat to go and get. It's not very good.
No,
but I thought
it's
it
not
was
really for a child. It's wonderful.
It's sweet,
right? And that,
well,
it's not that sweet.
No, all it is a disc of sponge cake,
right.
And
this
crenellated cardboard.
It was the cardboard.
And then you could push up.
Right. And on top of that was whipped cream with a cherry.
Yeah.
So what could be bad to a kid? You eat the whipped cream, you lick off the whipped cream,
yeah,
and then you have a little sort of wet piece of sponge cake. Anyway, but I have to say, Kara, I need to give you a tour of Jewish bakeries in Brooklyn, because we have a lot. And it's very easy to find almost everything, but the breads are not the same, of course.
Mm.
That there is a bakery called Corns, which has several retail shops.
That was one of the ones we tried.
Corns with a K makes decent cornbread. It's not as sour and as damp.
I know. It was in our trial run.
I know. It's just not as good, but it's there.
Now, well, hopefully good things are replacing some of these vanishing flavors. But again, back to the family memories. people aren't cooking the same. They're not cooking those dishes. Of course, at holiday time, don't you have relatives? Some of the relatives pull out all the stops.
Well, here's the problem.
Arthur pulls out the stops.
No, here's a problem with Jewish food. People don't make dishes on a daily basis. They make everything they know
for the holiday.
On the one day. So, you know, of course you leave the table feeling like a slug.
Right.
You just, you know, ate way too much meat and potatoes and whatever, that heavy food. So if you ate, for instance, a meal of sweet and sour flanken, one of my favorite things.
Your recipe for it.
Yes, your recipe too. Right?
Is it in the book?
Yes.
Is it yours?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was sweet and sour flanken. I love sweet and sour flanken. And you serve it with a little potato kugel and some broccoli. It's a well-balanced meal.
Broccoli.
And I make the flanken a day ahead so I can skim off all the fat. You don't serve it with all the fat on top.
Oh, my God, it sounds so good.
I have to say, many years ago, when I was working on my Jewish cookbook, Jewish Home Cooking, a very famous food editor came to me and said, "Oh, what are you working on now, Arthur?" I said, "Oh, I'm doing a Jewish cookbook, finally." And she said, "Oh, Jewish food is disgusting."
And I said,
"Well, it wasn't in my house." And she said, "Well, I had a Jewish grandmother." By the way, this is a woman you never would have believed was Jewish by her Locust Valley Lockjaw accent. She said, I had a Jewish grandmother, and her food was horrible. I said, "I'm sorry your grandmother couldn't cook, but my grandmother could cook. And we ate very, very well." My grandmother, by the way, was born in Brooklyn, very American, but knew all the old dishes, mm-hmm. and we ate them not just on the holiday.
Now, the dishes I want to talk about too is the food that's represented here is largely Eastern European food, which New Yorkers in the general population identify as Jewish food, even though there are so many different types of Jewish food.
And the first Jews in New York were Sephardim.
That's
right. That's right. And so,
wherever Jews go, they have to, you know, they follow Jewish dietary laws. But we like to assimilate. So we eat whatever the locals are eating. We just adapt it to our own dietary laws.
So let's talk about salami.
Oh.
But, of course, it's beef salami. And what is this? What is the attraction of
hard to find a good salami these days.
Sending salamis, okay.
To your boys in the army.
Send a salami to your boy in the army. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that sign still hangs in Kansas.
It does.
You know, behind the
that was actually a song. So send a salami to your boy in the army.
And then you have.
I would mail order a salami. There is one salami in America that I would get by mail. In fact, I should call them. It's called Atman's Delicatessen in Baltimore. And I was bemoaning the fact that a Hebrew National to me doesn't taste like salami anymore, and all the old salami companies are gone. So somebody wrote to me and said, "Try Atman's in Baltimore." All right, so I'm on a cruise. This is no joke. I was on an East Coast. I was hired to be on this cruise, and one of the ports is Baltimore. So what am I going to do in Baltimore for a day? I actually went to college at the University of Maryland, so I know Baltimore. Anyway, so I went to the old Jewish neighborhood, which is very close to the port, and I went to Atman's and tried the salami, loved the salami, bought home a 30-inch salami. Have to go through customs when you get off the ship in Florida. I never left the U.S. And the customs man says, "Are you carrying any meat?" Because, of course, it's illegal to bring in meat from foreign countries. I said, "Yeah, I have a salami, but I bought it in Baltimore." And he said, "Well, I have to look at it." I said, "But we've never left the U.S. He said, "You were in international waters." I said, "In other words, I bought a salami in the middle of the Atlantic, kosher no less."
Did you get to keep the salami? Of course, it was
way too much salami for me, but I couldn't resist a 30-inch salami.
Oh, my God.
Now, my nephew actually owns a delicatessen in St. Louis, an old family delicatessen called Protzels. And he did have a great salami until about 2 years ago, when that salami plant in Chicago, which was bought out by Sara Lee closed this kosher salami plant down, and that was the end of this great salami from Chicago.
Wow.
So there's not a lot of good salami around.
Right. Okay, well, I want to ask, it's that, you know, $60,000 question, and I hate to put everyone on the spot. But, Jordan, I want to ask you first, what you had something you wanted to say about a salami. But then I wanted to ask you, I wanted to ask everybody, so you have time to think, okay, your favorite or fondest or most important food memory. And it doesn't have to be necessarily in the book, but it probably is.
Actually, mine, it's immediate, and it is in the book. Aaron and I each wrote a little blurb about, you know, our author's comments. And I remember the tradition of my grand. I only had one grandparent. I was the youngest of the youngest of the youngest, and by the time I was born, all three grandparents were gone. So I bonded very closely with my bubby Ethel Rabin, and she was the cook. She was the cook, and we all schlepped over to her house for every holiday dinner. And of course, as there is another story in the book, a lot of my family didn't get along, but at Bubby Ethel's on Rosh Hashanah, they got along. And I was always seated at the cousin's table, which was usually a card table set up at the end of the regular table. And I will never forget the ritual of Bubby Ethel carrying out, waddling, and, you know, from the kitchen with platters of gribbenous chicken feet, all of the gorgel and the herzl, the giblets and gribbenous, because everyone else said, "Oh, that's icky. I don't want that." I loved it, and she loved
better
that.
Better define gribbenous.
What?
Better say what gribbenous are.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Gribbenous is the Jewish equivalent of pork rinds.
Pork rinds.
It's crackling.
And from the making of gribbenous,
like chicken potato, chicken chips.
From the making of gribbenous, you get chicken schmaltz. The fat and the skin renders the chicken schmaltz, which you then separate. But then you left over with these Jewish popcorn.
Yeah. Right. Fried bits of skin.
Right. Yeah,
fried bits. So fantastic.
All right.
God.
If anyone who's a picker, you know, when you roast a chicken, you know. That's
oh, right.
What's to be bad. Okay, Arthur.
It's either making pickles, lacto-fermented cucumbers, with my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, or the ordeal of making gefilte fish with my grandmother. And Aaron has a picture of the meat grinder that all
yes.
our grannies used.
My mother had one of those too.
My grandmother would attach it to a wooden chair in the middle of the kitchen and put a bowl on the floor, which I didn't understand until I tried to do this myself. A bowl on the floor, and I was to grind it. So as an adult, I still have the grinder. The one that's in Aaron's picture.
Yeah.
And they still sell them, by the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the problem with this grinder, and if you look at Aaron's picture closely, you'll see that he resolved this photographically. The bowl will not fit underneath the grinder if the grinder is attached to a table.
Right.
So that's why my grandmother had to put it on a chair and the bowl on the floor, and why I, as a boy, didn't really mind grinding. But as an adult, it killed my back to have to bend over and do the grinding.
Right.
So that was an ordeal.
Okay, Kara.
Well, one of them I already said, which was Jewish corn rye with sweet butter and a sprinkling of salt. The other thing I remember very intensely is that my grandmother had a green pot. I don't know what it was made out of, but the outside color was green. And then out of that would come the most extraordinary. It was a pot full of wonder. And one of the things that I remember particularly is that in addition to serving her matzo balls or knedlach in soup, she would also create what we would now call caramelized onions, but for her was just browning, a pool of browned onions and garlic, and she would brown the knedlach, the matzo balls, in them and serve them as a side, along with brisket or potted chicken or some other kind of meat. Those were kreplach. And they were heaven. They
absolutely
just remain in my mind.
I can taste it now, Carol.
Okay, and last but not least, Aaron.
Well, we just touched on it, but I can't stop remembering my grandmother making kreplach. It was a huge festive occasion. I loved them. She loved making them. She made them by the hundreds. It was a huge ordeal. I had about 10 or 12 cousins that lived in Brooklyn, and she would make it for everyone. And it was just made with such just love and joy. And she made them with potatoes, stuffed with potatoes, sometimes stuffed with blueberries, sometimes stuffed with chicken liver, sometimes stuffed with meat. And we ate them fried. We ate them in soup. We ate them plain. And it's just such a fond memory.
Wonderful. Well, I really hate to have to stop talking because this is such a fun conversation. But in interest of time, we do have to close. And I just want to remind people that the book is called Eating Delancey, A Celebration of Jewish Food. Aaron Resney and Jordan Shapps have put this together. And two of the contributors, Arthur Schwartz and Kara DeSilva, are here with me. And if you need a last-minute Hanukkah present, if you want a lovely treat for your own coffee table to sit out and look at, this is a book that you won't be disappointed in. And these are memories that I hope people will continue to talk about, because they are certainly cherished. You can feel the importance out of this book. And thank you all so much for joining
me
today.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.